KALW.
Even if you were to use 100% clean energy to make cement via the conventional way, the majority of the emissions would still persist.
Cement and concrete produce almost as much carbon dioxide as cars.
So we are pouring a cement replacement and low-carbon concrete for all the foundations, walls, and slabs.
Today, we'll hear about addressing concrete's climate problem, then a change to high school suspension rules in California.
This is a student that's going to just end up dead or in jail. Okay, it is what it is. They didn't really care to understand me or try, really just be there.
It's a story from our podcast, TBH. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. We know that cars and planes and even landfills contribute to climate change, but there's another big source of planet-warming gases, and it's all around us. It may even be around you right now as you listen. We're talking about concrete and the cement used to make it. KALW climate reporter Mary Catherine O'Connor explains the climate-focused makeover that's happening to the production of concrete.
I'm in San Francisco's Laurel Village neighborhood, on a corner that's normally pretty sleepy. But on this summer morning, a small army of hard-hatted construction workers is pounding nails and welding metal inside a three-story steel frame. They're working on the expansion campus for University High School. I'm here to learn about something foundational to this building, like literally the foundation, the concrete. And that's the domain of construction director Michael Smith, who tells me more.
So the concrete is provided by Central. They have a batch plant that's supplying this job.
Concrete has three main ingredients: cement, water, and a mix of gravel and sand, or something called aggregate.
The cement comes from China, and the aggregate comes from some quarries in British Columbia, and that's brought via barge.
Those ingredients then make their way to Central, or one of a handful of other Bay Area concrete suppliers. Then they're mixed up and funneled into trucks that stream in and out of job sites just like this one. And at similar sites all over the world, every day. Concrete is the most widely consumed man-made material on Earth. It's also a huge driver of climate change.
Cement and concrete are about 5.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. If you just talk about CO2, it's like 7 or 8% of CO2 emissions.
That's Cody Finke. He's the co-founder and CEO of a company called Brimstone. And to put that 7 to 8% of global carbon emissions into context, it's roughly equal to CO2 emissions from all cars. And you might think that what drives concrete's emissions is all of that shipping of ingredients from faraway places. But actually, just one of those ingredients is the big culprit, the cement.
Right. Without cement, concrete is just a pile of wet, sandy gravel, right? But cement is actually what gives the concrete structure. It's also responsible for about 90% of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with producing concrete.
So I'm here at his company's lab to learn how Brimstone is trying to fix that problem by making cement without the CO2.
So I'll just kind of walk you around, maybe I'll just go through the whole.
Their R&D space looks like a chemistry lab crossed with a commercial kitchen and a really clean automotive garage.
And that roll-up door is where we do our rock crushing.
Lab technicians put baseball-sized rocks into an industrial grinder. The rocks go through a bunch of crushing and then filtering and then more crushing until they're pulverized into a powder. A chemical agent is added. And to me, it just looks like a slurry. You can't see how it's different or special, but it is. So listen up. This is the important science part.
Cement is a calcium-based material, and where we get calcium today is a rock called limestone.
But in addition to calcium, limestone contains a lot of carbon dioxide. And when you heat the limestone to make cement, that CO2 gets released. Not to mention the CO2 from the heating process alone. You could use renewable energy to generate the heat, but that would only erase some of the total CO2 emissions.
Even if you were to use 100% clean energy to make cement via the conventional way, the majority of the emissions would still persist.
So Brimstone's answer to that problem is to make cement out of a different material, one that doesn't contain CO2.
It turns out there is one other rock that is globally abundant on Earth that contains calcium, which is a silicate rock.
This is not exotic stuff. Granite is an example of a silicate rock. So is basalt. The silicate slurry is then mixed with a few other ingredients and heated to form a cement that works just like limestone cement. In fact, last year, Brimstone earned the certification needed to prove it. And that's really important to ensure industry acceptance.
Okay, what's going on in this part?
So this is our concrete lab, and this is where we basically test the attributes of the cement that we produce.
Here, a lab tech puts a small cube made with Brimstone cement into a contraption that compresses it to test its strength. These cubes are small, roughly the size of children's building blocks. Looking at these and then trying to imagine how much concrete you'd need to build something like the Bay Bridge, it made me realize Brimstone has a long way to go. Even though the startup raised over $60 million in venture capital, and that was before landing a huge grant from the Department of Energy this spring, $189 million.
So we're working on a pilot plant, which will be over in Reno, Nevada.
Still, Brimstone is trying to break into a very old, established industry. If they can successfully scale up production, then comes the question, will anyone use their cement? And that's largely up to another player we haven't even talked about yet, designers and architects.
I'm Frances Yang. I'm a structures and sustainability specialist here in the San Francisco office of AREP.
AREP has worked on lots of concrete-heavy Bay Area projects, including the San Francisco International Airport and the city's Museum of Modern Art. And Frances has been pushing for new standards and laws aimed at climate innovations in building materials. She says companies like Brimstone face a classic chicken and egg problem.
They need the demand to secure the financing to scale.
But when you're only making small samples of your product, it's hard to create enough of that demand from customers because
they want to see examples of it in use and successful at scale that they're building.
But even if Brimstone can secure customers, building up their manufacturing capability will take time. Fortunately, less carbon-intensive concrete already exists. It's not as clean as Brimstone's, it's more in the middle ground, and it's actually been around for a while. To make it, suppliers put less cement in their concrete mix and compensate for that with other materials that can do the same job without all of the emissions. This type of concrete is in the eastern span of the Bay Bridge, and it's what's getting poured at University High School campus in Laurel Village. A few weeks later, when I stop by the construction site again, a truck is pumping the wet concrete through a wide hose up to the second floor, where about 15 men are moving fast to cover and smooth it out over a grid of rebar. It's like a choreographed dance. Here's Mike Smith again, who leads the concrete team.
So we are pouring a cement replacement and low-carbon concrete for all the foundations, walls, and slabs here on this project.
And it means this concrete has up to 50% lower global warming potential compared to conventional concrete. Of course, this lower carbon option is still reliant on an exceptionally high carbon industry, coal-fired power plants.
The fly ash, it's a byproduct of the coal power plant industry, and it is brought via rail from New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, comes from different sources.
And those sources are drying up as coal plants close. But that doesn't matter, because eventually builders will need to go greener. California legislators passed a bill in 2021 that could mandate zero carbon concrete by 2045. That will give a leg up to manufacturers like Brimstone, so long as they keep grinding rocks into cement that's easy on the climate. In San Francisco, I'm Mary Catherine O'Connor for Cross Currents.
Mary Catherine is KLW's climate reporter. You can find the rest of her stories at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Last week, a new California law went into effect that bans suspensions from school based on willful defiance, a low-level behavioral violation. Students can still be removed from classrooms for willful defiance, but not from schools. Research shows that at-risk students have been more likely to receive these suspensions compared to their classmates. Today, we'll revisit a 2020 story about school suspensions from TBH producer Messiah Edwards.
In the Bay Area, officials are beginning to rethink criminalizing kids. Last year, San Francisco supervisors voted to close down Juvenile Hall. Activists like Julia Arroyo with the Young Women's Freedom Center have demanded that for a long time.
The ancestors spoke, and it was time to, like, just really push to close down this place.
Over in Oakland, the Black Organizing Project has been pushing to kick district police out of schools for nearly a decade. They succeeded this year.
For those adults that are afraid, it is time for you to be inconvenienced like our children have for years.
Jasmine Williams with the Black Organizing Project describes this victory as momentum, meeting the moment.
We wanted to abolish the school police department as a marker of a larger political move to really transform education and start investing in supports that youth need.
This issue really hits home for me. I'm Black, so I have to see oppression and discrimination happen against the people in my community all day, every day. I see it in our San Francisco neighborhoods and in our schools. I know how common it is for young people to be disciplined instead of listened to. The school to prison pipeline often begins with suspensions. I was suspended for the first time when I was 7 years old. A boy was harassing me, so my first reaction was to defend myself. For that, I got suspended. But boys continue to harass and pick on me. You get fed up after a while being pushed around so many times, so I would fight back. And then I would get suspended from school. Over and over again. Each time, the teacher saw the tension building up, but didn't do anything about it. It never felt like anyone wants to hear the full story.
Suspension works in different ways. It deprives you of the physical opportunity to be in school and get the support you might not otherwise have.
Laura Bazelon directs the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Clinic at the University of San Francisco. And she's right. After you're suspended, you fall behind in school. Your main focus becomes dealing with other students who want to know what happened or trying to avoid them. Your main focus becomes trying to survive.
It also can fill you with a real sense of despair and belief that the system is not fair, which I should point out, it is not.
The number of students suspended in California schools each year has steadily declined, but the racial disparities haven't gone away. Nationwide, a report from Columbia Law School found that Black girls are 6 times as likely to be suspended as white girls.
When you combine all of that, what you get is the likelihood for this person to go down a path that is going to lead to what I call system involvement, to involvement in the criminal justice system.
When I was a freshman, I read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. I've always been very blunt, but as I began to read and learn more about the systems that were put up against me, I started to think, okay, now I have something new to speak out against and be more blunt about. I speak out for people in my community, like my friend Kevin Lindsay.
Honestly,
I liked school until I started getting in trouble.
Kevin and I met while we were working together at San Francisco's Pier 39. He's 18 years old now. He's goofy and loves basketball. But he says people view him as a threat.
A lot of people would be nervous when they see me because I'm tall and I'm big and I'm black. But honestly, I'm very friendly, and that's what a lot of people don't see me.
Like me, Kevin has been suspended from school for fighting since he was young. When he returns to class, school security guards start to follow him around, and teachers begin to see him differently.
They kind of would just treat me like I'm a criminal. Like, they didn't really care to understand me.
Students who are suspended are more likely to be involved in the juvenile justice system. Kevin knows the cycle. His mom, dad, and three brothers have all been incarcerated.
Okay, so this is a student that's gonna just end up dead or in jail. Like, they just was like, okay, it is what it is. Like, that's just Kevin.
When Kevin was a freshman, he got into another fight. This was in 2017, the year his 15-year-old brother was shot and killed.
I was sad and angry all the time. Like, I was just sad because it's like, I was broke. So as soon as somebody would do anything to me, I was going to let them have it because I couldn't release my anger and my sadness any other way. I didn't know how to.
But after this fight, he was sent to juvenile hall.
I'm thinking I'm going to get out in an hour or two because I went to jail for fighting. Like, I'm like, this is crazy. Like, I never heard of this. A school fight, I'm going to jail. Like, I just never heard of that. So I'm like, I'm going to get out. My mom's going to pick me up. And then when I got there, they started giving me clothes and stuff. And I'm like, why am I getting clothes? Like, I'm about to leave, right? And they was telling me that I wasn't. So then I'm like, okay, this is starting to get serious.
Kevin was locked up for 4 days. He says the whole school knew about the fight before it even happened, but no adult stepped in. And he says the pain has been building up inside him for years.
I feel like it first started with my environment where I was growing up and my family being broken. I would say like us all already like going through a lot and us being broke. I feel like that's how it started it. And then I feel like my school could have prevented it.
Instead of offering Kevin support when he needed it, the school suspended him. Then they sent him to jail. Luckily, Kevin met adults who wanted him to succeed. The counselors at Juvenile Hall knew his family and saw potential in him.
Everybody knows the Lindsays. That's my last name. Everybody know the Lindsays are being in jail. The police know, like, that's in my neighborhood, they know. For him to speak good on me and my family for the first time, it felt so much to me. It made me so happy. It's just like, somebody sees good in us, and I honestly thought nobody did.
Kevin started talking to a security guard at his school named Chi. She grew up in San Francisco's Fillmore District. He knew Kevin's dad, his brother, and understood what he was going through. They played basketball together and talked about the future.
He was just telling me that that's not the life that you want to live. I got to do what I got to do. I got to go to school. I have to. I started to make it to where I don't have an option. This is what I'm going to do, and that's that. I gotta accept it and I gotta start to like it. And that's what I did.
This makes me think about my own mentor. He was a high school principal and one of the few black people I knew at the school. He had to deal with the same issues I've had to deal with. Now, it's Kevin and I supporting each other. When we first met about a year ago, he asked me what I would do if I saw him homeless 10 years from now. I asked him the same question and in my head I thought, we've got to do something with our lives. And then I told him he should join the Omega Alive and Free Boys Club. It's a violence prevention program in San Francisco that offers academic tutoring and scholarships. I heard about it from my mentor, Tashel Heron Lane, and Kevin agreed to go. It was co-founded by Dr. Joseph Marshall.
Instead of saying stop the violence, I wanted the young people to look forward to something, and staying alive and free was what I always told them to do.
When I walked into Omega, the first thing I noticed was the black and brown faces plastered on the walls. I had never seen so many faces the same color as mine in graduation attire. We would go to Omega for hours every week. It was like school after school. We learned how to be financially literate, how to be good at math, and to know our history. At the end of the program, I asked Dr. Marshall about the faces on the walls.
We had a lot of tests, and those that passed the tests are up on the wall at the club.
People who graduate college make it on the wall.
Now approaching 250 college graduates.
Yes.
And somebody named Masai Edwards is trying to get in the group. So,
yes, definitely. You should definitely pick her.
We'll see if she makes it to the wall, but I got a feeling that she will.
I know in 4 years, I'll be one of those smiling faces motivating the next Omegas. We recently had a virtual graduation to celebrate completing the 9-month program. Kevin and I attended, and one of the mentors gave a speech.
I want to encourage you to do more than what you did. We set the bar high because we believe in you. It's demanding because you're brilliant, you're capable, you're able.
This all meant a lot to me because I finished high school during a pandemic. I got a full ride during a pandemic. I attended a program during a pandemic. And now I'm going to college during a pandemic.
Thank all of you for spending this time tonight. And as always, stay alive and free. That's it. Good
stay
night.
Alive and free. Good night.
Good night.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Y'all next week.
Bye.
Bye.
We often say kids are the future. But what is the future when they're behind bars? We have to think, do we want to give children a chance? Because too often, we see consequences, but not any form of rehabilitation.
Masaya reported that story in 2020 as part of our TBH series, the KALW podcast made by, about, and for teenagers. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. As temperatures go up, so does anxiety about the climate.
It's a deep kind of grieving. It's a deep kind of sadness as we experience the destruction of the place that we know as home.
Climate change and mental health, tomorrow morning at 11. Before we leave you, here's some new music from a local band. This is Sour Widows. They'll be performing at the Independent in San Francisco this Saturday.
There's a path that takes you, and it's gonna take me too. Cleaving the granite edge, heaven spilling.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Aru Nair, Zain Iqbal, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adel, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. We
Welcome to my mixtape.
My name is Maciel Jaquez. I'm from Oakland, California, East Oakland specifically. My song is Black Magic Woman by Carlos Santana. I have grown up to his music, and ever since I was about 5 years old, I always wanted to be a Black Magic Woman, because I thought any person who is powerful and strong enough to inspire this person to write this song, then I want to be her.
Got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman. I've got a black magic woman. Got me so blind I can't see. She's a black magic woman. She's trying to make a double.